Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Remington, 1894, by William W. Johnstone and J. A. Johnstone. Narrated by Al Kessel. Chapter 1.
Hola, hombre!
Jerking awake, John McMasters opened his eyes and inwardly cursed himself for falling asleep. He wet his cracked lips and glanced at his right thigh. Blood-soaked, even though he'd tied his bandana over the wound, secured the frayed piece of cotton to the barrel of his Colt 45 caliber peacemaker, and twisted the long barrel to tighten his makeshift tourniquet. How long had he been asleep? He wasn't certain. Sweat stung his eyes, and he blinked before he turned the revolver with his left hand, loosening the bandana, letting blood flow a little more freely. He remembered that from what the Sawbones had told him more than 30 years earlier.
Blood has to flow, else it destroys the tissue, leads to moist gangrene.
The doctor took a long pull from a bottle, shook his head, and laughed.
Problem is, you slow the blood too much, and that can lead to dry gangrene. Your sergeant, well, you don't have to worry about moist or dry. Hold him down, boy, as I saw off his leg.
The Mexican's voice made the image of that Union doctor vanish.
Hombre, are you alive?
McMasters almost laughed. Had the Mexican kept quiet, he likely could have climbed right up the ridge, planted a revolver barrel against McMaster's temple, and blown his head off.
Yeah.
His own voice was barely audible. He coughed, wiped away more sweat, tried to swallow, and attempted to speak again.
Still here.
Bueno,
the Mexican said.
Buenos tardes. We, negociar. Parley, me and you. I speak for Butcher.
The name made McMaster stiffen. He fought down the bile. Moses Butcher. Shaking his head to clear his thoughts, McMasters looked down at his leg again, and next tried to find the sun, but had no luck. The air turned cooler in these tree-studded hills near Bisbee, not far from the Mexican border. He looked at the blood pouring out of the hole in his woolen trousers, grimaced, and twisted the barrel of the Colt until the blood stopped flowing and his leg resumed an intense throbbing. Straightening, he gathered his shotgun and found the bandit, more of a blur than an actual target. McMasters had lost his eyeglasses scrambling up the hill.
Hombre?
The Mexican called once more. What was the bandit's name? Again, John McMaster shook his head. He studied the rugged terrain, the only way out of the canyon that McMaster's now guarded. The sweat hampered his view, which did not help his lousy eyesight to begin with.
You are a lone hombre, the Mexican said, and you have fought a good fight. But now, we think it is best that you quit. Señor, you are foolish to have come here alone. You should have brought a posse with you.
Yeah, McMaster said with a bitter laugh, though too softly for the bandit to hear him. I had a posse. A posse straight out of hell. He had hired them to help him track down Moses Butcher and his killers, then, at the last moment, had turned them loose, sent them away. Well, it wasn't like he could have stopped them anyway. Besides, he wanted to kill Moses Butcher himself. Not with the Colt, though. The 45 had a more important job, keeping McMasters from bleeding to death. And the 45 was empty.
Hombre?
McMasters found the strength from somewhere and managed to push himself up against the boulder he leaned against. He had to catch his breath. Blinking away more sweat, he turned his head. His left hand held the handle of the empty revolver. His right hand moved the other weapon, bracing it against the twisted branch of a dead juniper. The shotgun weighed just less than 8 pounds. It felt like 800.
Yeah.
He remembered the name of the bandit, or at least the name on the wanted dodgers. What do you want, Greaser? Greaser. Greaser Gomez. John McMasters had never cared much for that derogatory name many Arizona whites called Mexicans. Greasers. Bean eaters. Hell, the Mexicans had been in this country long before the white men. So had the Apaches, but most of those were long gone. Greasers. The term reviled a Wisconsin-born Yankee like him. But Greaser Gomez sickened McMasters even more, especially now that he saw the outlaw had tied a scarf around the barrel of his Winchester repeater. He could not see the killer so distinctly, but the scarf, that came to him clearer than his memories or his dreams. Gomez kept waving that barrel back and forth, the whiteness of the silk showing brilliantly in the sun shining from a clearing. It illuminated the killer. Mostly, it turned the silk scarf into a beacon. John McMasters could not take his eyes off the waving cloth.
"Listen, hombre, you are tough to kill."
"I'm alive," McMasters whispered, more to himself.
"That is what Butcher says,"
the bandit went on.
"You are tough, hombre, and I agree."
The carbine stopped waving, and Gomez's right hand moved away from the holstered revolver on his hip, reaching over the big Sugarloaf sombrero, and began pointing.
"This is what we call," he grinned, "a Mexican standoff."
He laughed at his joke, or what he thought was a joke.
"You cannot go anywhere. We cannot go anywhere."
The hand returned to its perch on the pearl handle of the revolver.
"There is no point."
"Isn't there?" McMasters called out. He strained, trying to guess how far away Gomez stood, while silently cursing his vision. 40 yards? 50? Maybe as far away as 60. He looked at the shotgun, the barrel still perched on the dead branch, the stock braced against Gomez's right shoulder. 50, McMasters finally guessed. A long way for a shotgun, and pushing the accuracy of a revolver, although everyone said Greaser Gomez rarely missed. The outlaw also held that Winchester repeater in his left hand.
"We don't even know who you are, or why you chase us."
"Don't you?" McMasters wet his lips and looked beyond Gomez. The Mexican stepped closer. Was that a trick? McMasters listened with intent for anything out of the ordinary, the clattering of a stone, the snapping of a branch. Nothing. No animals, not even birds, not even flies, made a noise, and the wind no longer blew. The silk scarf hung limp along the barrel of Gomez's carbine.
"No, hombre. You tell us. You want money? Dinero? We might be able to work out a deal. Butcher, he has some gold, some greenbacks."
"No deal."
The Mexican shook his head.
"But why? For what reason do you chase us, Digome? You have trailed us for a long time, but even those men who were with you earlier, back in the superstitions and at that boom town, they realized that there was no point. They left you, hombre."
Beneath that ugly beard, Gomez grinned again, a vile, evil, despicable smile that did not require the eyesight of a 20-year-old to detect.
"They left you. Alone.
Like you said, you have nowhere to go as long as I'm here."
"You won't be here long, hombre."
The humor had left Gomez's voice, and his grips tightened on both the revolver and the Winchester.
"We are many. You are one."
"You aren't as many as you were earlier."
Again, Gomez shook his head.
"This parley. It works on my throat. I have a flask in my back pocket."
The right hand left the revolver, and a finger pointed behind him.
"Is it all right with you, hombre, if I've wet my windpipe?"
"Trying to get at me," McMasters thought. "Drink some tequila, or mezcal, or whiskey, or even water. Water would be better. remind me of how they have water. And my canteen is on the saddle of a dead horse out there, in the open, unreachable, without catching lead.
"Salud," he said.
Laughing, Gomez found the flask, twisted off the cap, and brought the engraved pewter container to his lips. His Adam's apple bobbed, and the laughter returned to the killer's dark eyes. McMasters glanced at his thigh, loosened the barrel of the Colt, let the blood flow a little more, and then tightened the bandana again when he heard Gomez sighing with pleasure. The flask returned to the rear pocket of the killer's denim breeches. The right hand found its rest on the butt of the holstered revolver, and he stepped still closer. Closer to being able to kill John McMasters. Yet also closer to McMasters and his shotgun.
"It is many hours before sunset, amigo," the outlaw said.
"So, we're friends now," McMasters thought.
"I would like to take my siesta, but I would rather take it with a puta."
He grinned once more.
"In Bisbee."
"Bisbee?"
McMasters said with skepticism. The Mexican laughed.
"Well, no, not Bisbee. There is law in Bisbee. You Norteamericanos frown upon men of me honestidad. But south of Bisbee, in the country where my father and mother were born, in the country where I was born, my homeland."
McMasters did not reply. He kept listening, but did not want to take his eyes off Greaser Gomez. Do that, make that one mistake, and the killer would try to kill him. The shotgun, despite braced against the tree and partially by the boulder, felt even heavier. McMaster's leg pounded, and he wished he had not let Gomez drink from that flask, for his throat felt raw, drier than it had. His stomach began to rebel. A bullet was lodged in his thigh, and he had lost a lot of blood. He had no water, no food, nothing but an empty .45 revolver and a double-barreled shotgun. And resolve. And the Winchester began swaying again, making the silk scarf wave. And memories. McMaster's heart ached. He bit his bottom lip to keep it from quavering.
"There is something you should know, hombre,"
Greaser Gomez said.
"Yeah?"
Speaking that one syllable hurt.
"I told you that it was time for my siesta. That is an important thing in my country, with my people. But..."
The Winchester stopped waving, and his right hand lifted to point in McMaster's direction.
"I, Moses Butcher, the others. Well, we can take a little siesta. We can sleep all day, all night. But you, amigo, you must stay awake."
"I was sleeping just before you started talking, you damned idiot."
McMasters knew Gomez spoke the truth and did not need to explain his veiled threat. John McMasters was alone, wounded, weak, and growing weaker with every passing second. He counted what he knew of Butcher's men. He had more than just Greaser Gomez, 5 more. Total of 7, including Butcher and Gomez. He shook his head. No, only 6. The 7th lay spread-eagled near his bloating horse. And maybe not even 6. McMasters had emptied his Colt as he ran for shelter in the rocks and trees. He had heard a shot before starting the last gunfight, and knew one of Butcher's men had been wounded earlier. So maybe that man was out of commission, even dead, and maybe McMasters had killed some others.
Maybe. If.
He sighed. Even if he had killed or wounded one or two others, there would still be too many. At some point, he would fall asleep again. His leg throbbed even worse than earlier, and he loosened the tourniquet for only a moment. Another thought numbed him.
Or I'll just
bleed to death.
So,
Greaser Gomez waved the scarf briefly.
Hombre, here is our, how do you call it? Moses, he told me. A truce. Si, tregua. Truce, si. We will ride away. I tell Moses, I say, vámonos que mi muero de hambre.
Gomez laughed at his joke.
Moses, he tells me to come up and parley with you. So this is how it will be.
The smile seemed to disappear in Gomez's thick, matted black beard.
We ride down this trail, one at a time. If you break our tregua, our, truce, then we kill you. And you will not enjoy your death, for it will be a long time before it comes to you, amigo. Savvy?
A breeze kicked up, and the scarf began waving again without any help from Greaser Gomez. McMasters watched it, remembering, and did not look at the killer. Clearly, he studied that flag of truce.
When we are gone and all alive, we will leave you in peace. That is our proposal. Do you find the terms acceptable?
Just as quickly as it had started, the wind died, and the white fabric fell again, wrapping around the Winchester's barrel. McMaster's cold blue eyes locked on Greaser Gomez.
No,
he answered flatly. With a sigh, Gomez shook his head.
I am sorry, hombre, for I am truly hungry and wanted to leave here and leave you alive. A man like you, so tough, so full of valor, I will not enjoy killing you. But now one of us, perhaps it will be me, will have to kill you.
It won't be you, McMaster said.
Gomez's face went taut.
What?
McMaster's cut him off. Butcher was smart, not coming up here by himself. He sent you. You weren't smart, Gomez. Beneath that black beard, the outlaw's darkened face seemed to pale. He stepped back, waving the carbine frantically, pointing to it with his right hand.
Señor, hombre, amigo, do you not recognize this, what this means? Por Dios, it is...
It was, McMasters corrected, not letting the killer answer. It was a Christmas gift. Last December, I gave it to my oldest daughter, Rosalie. He tightened the shotgun stock against his shoulder.
Before you, Butcher, and the rest of you black-hearted sons of bitches cut her down, and the rest of my family.
The Winchester dropped. So did Gomez's right hand, and he sang out some curse, or perhaps a prayer in Spanish. As the carbine clanked against the rocks, soiling that white piece of silk, the revolver jerked out of the Mexican's holster. McMasters did not have time to think why Gomez would go for his shotgun when a carbine seemed the wiser choice. McMasters turned his focus on aiming his shotgun. There were no hammers to cock on that model. It would be a chancy shot, especially for a 50-year-old man who needed spectacles to see far. Greaser Gomez had been more blur than features. It was why John McMasters carried the Remington Model 1894 12-gauge shotgun with him. It was why he had loaded both barrels with buckshot. Remembering Rosalie, remembering his wife, his sons, his youngest daughter, remembering the life he had once enjoyed, and seeing clearly, or so it seemed, Greaser Gomez thumbing back the hammer of his pistol, John McMasters squeezed both triggers. Chapter 2. 9 days earlier. The colt looked up, perked its ears, and snorted.
Snorted?
John McMasters figured the stubborn bay was laughing at him. Slowly, he swung down from the Dunhee Road and easily removed the lariat. It was July, but high up on the Mogollon Rim, the air felt cool, and dark clouds threatened rain later in the afternoon. In Arizona, They called that time of year monsoon season, and McMasters wanted to get home with the runaway colt before there came a soaking, hard, cold rain. Maybe some hail. He remembered old Jake Willis. Caught in a monsoon 2 summers back, he and his horse had been killed by a lightning strike. "Easy, boy," McMaster said to the colt. He ground-reined his dun, and his boots clopped on the hard rock surface as he approached the edge of the rim. The colt took a step back, and McMaster stopped. He had come too far to watch his colt tumble over the edge of the rim. Behind was the vast empty. Only a few pines poked above the rim, growing from the side of the hill or maybe a ridge outcropping. If the colt fell to the ridge, McMasters would have no way of getting it up, not even if he had plenty of help. If the colt missed the ridge, it was a long, long way down to nothing but more pines and rocks. 2 ravens flew past, fighting hard against the wind that picked up with fury. McMasters raised his left hand to pull down his hat tighter on his head. He looked back at his saddle, knowing what he would find. Nothing. Not even a bedroll. He should have brought along a slicker, but when he had discovered that James, his son, had left the corral open that morning, he didn't think he would still be looking for the runaway colt far away from his ranch and high up on the Mogollon in the afternoon. He could smell rain. Worse, he could feel the electricity in the air. The colt whinnied, but did not move away from the rim's edge. McMasters took another step. Slowly. Another. He began to sing. "The Union forever. Hurrah, boys, hurrah. Down with the traitor, up with the star. While we rally round the flag, boys, rally once again, shouting the battle cry of freedom." The colt stared. The wind turned into a roar. McMasters raised his voice. "We are springing to the call with 1 million free men more, shouting the battle cry of freedom, and we'll fill our vacant ranks of our brothers gone before, shouting the battle cry of freedom." He reached the colt, let it smell his scent, and rubbed the bay's neck, widening the loop of the lariat and still singing. "The Union forever! Hurrah, boys, hurrah! Down with the traitor, up with the star! While we rally round the flag, boys, rally once again, shouting the battle cry of freedom." Slowly, carefully, he brought the lariat's loop over the colt's head and let out a sigh of relief. He took a moment to stare at the view. The pines bent to the wind, but beyond that, he saw those pine-covered hills, the deep, verdant valley, and beyond that, more mountains. It was almost the last thing John McMasters ever saw. The young colt pulled back, and its rear hooves slipped on the flat rocks. Squealing, the animal started backwards over the cliff. McMasters pulled hard on the rope and leaned back with all his might. The lariat burned through his gloves, and the colt kicked and lunged. Somehow, the animal regained its footing on the rock and ran forward. By then, McMasters was on his knees, the leather chaps protecting him. He came up, keeping a tight grip on the lariat, and stopped the colt from running. Heart racing, sweating profusely, McMasters stepped again toward the horse. He shot a glance at his own horse, relieved to see the dun staring at him with a bemused look. "That wasn't so damned funny." He sang again, "Yankee Doodle Dandy," but his voice cracked from fear. It took a while for his nerves to calm and his hands to stop shaking. Had the bay gone over the rim, McMasters knew he would have gone over with it. He would have been too damn stubborn to let go of the lariat. When the colt seemed calm, McMasters turned back to look at the view and shook his head. Years of experience and memories of old Jake Willis should have reminded him not to tarry. The Mogollon might be a beautiful place, but it could turn deadly in a heartbeat. "Come on, boy," he told the colt. "Let's go home." He kept singing, though softer as he guided the runaway toward the dun. we will welcome to our numbers the loyal, true, and brave, shouting the battle cry of freedom. And although he may be poor, he shall never be a slave, shouting the battle cry of freedom. Keeping a tight hold on the end of the lariat, McMaster swung into the saddle, gave the dun a kick, and led the bay colt away from the rim's edge. Hooves clapped against the stone until they reached the softer dirt, churned by wagon wheels and shod horses over the years, and took the trail that went down the Mogollon and into Payson. Before he reached Payson, however, he would be home. Maybe, he thought, I might even beat the monsoon home. Thunder cracked. Both the dun and the bay jumped, but McMasters kept his seat in the creaking saddle. Even more important, he kept his grip on the lead rope. He started to sing the next verse of the battle cry of freedom, if he could remember it. Soon it felt as though he were riding through the waterfall at Tonto Bridge, and quickly felt more like Niagara Falls. Numbingly cold rain stung more like hailstones than raindrops, and might indeed turn into hail before he ever reached his horse ranch. Sometimes the summer storms blew out quickly. Other times, they turned roads into mud bogs and could leave a man with a bad case of pneumonia, or fried to a crisp by lightning. John McMasters kept riding down the trail, pulling the colt behind him. He jerked down the brim of his hat, but that did not keep him dry. Hell, the monsoon had already soaked his clothes. The wet saddle rubbed against his wet pants. Happy birthday, McMaster said with resigned bitterness. To me.
My God, John, get out of those wet clothes now.
B practically jerked him inside their two-story home. Dripping wet, even though the monsoon had stopped 30 minutes before he reached the ranch, McMasters turned toward the potbelly stove with the coffee pot that looked so inviting, but his wife pushed him away and toward the bedroom.
After you've dressed, she ordered, do you need a hot bath?
I never want to feel water on me again, he mumbled, and settled into the chair.
I said,
let me get my boots off, he told B. Don't want me tracking mud to the bedroom. Although the rain had stopped before he reached home, it had turned the yard from the corrals and the barn to the nice home into a quagmire. He had already hung his chaps and his hat, both soaking wet, on a peg on the porch. B had to help him with the boots, so wet they felt like they had shrunk and sealed to his socks. The socks he somehow managed to pull off without his wife's help. At last he stood, shooting a glance at the coffee, but B gave him that look of a ranch foreman, or an army major, and he slowly moved toward the door that led to the bedroom.
I'll get you a towel, she said.
I might need a quilt.
You touch Grandmother Albertine's quilt, and you'll be sleeping in the barn, young man.
I'm not a young man anymore, B. He pulled off his eyeglasses, left them on the table by the rocker near the fireplace, and pushed open the door to the bedroom.
You're only 50, she told him.
Today, 50 feels like Methuselah.
I bet I can change that.
McMasters turned to see that devilish twinkle in her eyes.
Tonight,
she grinned.
Happy birthday, John.
He stood inside the bedroom, staring at her. She had turned 40 years old in January, but, even had he been wearing his spectacles, still looked 20, the age she had been when they had married on July 4, 1876. It was the best Independence Day he could recall since that day at Gettysburg, Pennsylvania, when he and the rest of Company G, and all the rest of General Meade's army, had stared across the mud and blood-soaked fields as the rain poured, and they had realized that there would be no battle, that they would live another day, that no more men killed, and that Robert E. Lee would be taking his Rebs out of Pennsylvania. Come to think of it, McMasters decided, July 4, 1863 hadn't been much of a national holiday after all. Hell, he thought, Our 20th anniversary passed 2 weeks earlier, and I...
Sample complete. Ready to continue?